This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Tefano, it's me, the Triple SD. Welcome to this Deep In Sessions. How are you? The frost hasn't settled. It's frozen solid. The fog has swallowed the streets and a heavy, suffocating midwinter dark has completely taken over Aotearoa. There's absolutely no light left at the end of the tunnel, so we are leaning entirely into the bleakness. Tonight marks our fourth and final session of the UTM takeover, and we are closing things out at absolute ground zero. for this final deep dive, I'm kicking it with Michelle, the absolute boss and mastermind behind UTM, to unpack the madness. Over the past month, this takeover has completely torn the roof off. We've descended into the shadows with the raw post-punk chaos of Trauma Party, the unforgiving, noise-drenched weight of Squeezed Circlutes. I'm so sorry, I can never say that. And the dark underground depth of Lung. Before we let Michelle unleash the final, heaviest sonic assault of the block, make sure you go and support the architects backing this heavy, distorted underground scene. Check out their full roster, releases, and merch over at utmmusic.net. Looking ahead, over the next sessions, I'll be focusing 100% on our Aotearoa sound. I have decided that the antidote to these dark days is supporting our culture 100% and militantly. If you're a band, DJ, avant-garde noise merchant, writing slam poetry, dark garage, straight up dub, or the nastiest trap, and everything in between, drop me an email, insessions9@gmail.com, or drop me a message on Facebook, also at Deep In Sessions. Don't look back. For the last time in this series, come with us as we deep dive our sound from the underground. Kia ora, Michelle. Welcome to this Deep In Sessions. How are you?
Kia ora. I'm recovering from a cold, but otherwise very good, and thank you very much for having me.
Oh, look, my pleasure. You know, what you do with UTM is absolutely astounding. I've got some questions that will allow us a deep dive. Should we hit it?
For sure.
Nice. So, spending decades in the DIY trenches usually means viewing the music industry as an adversary. When you transitioned to founding UTM, you essentially became the infrastructure, itself. How did you mentally navigate shifting from the artist fighting the system to the strategist building an alternative network for others?
I think it's a good question. I think it's not such a big transition as it might seem, and I think for me, it doesn't feel like I've sort of jumped the fence in any way at all. I think my role within the music scene has for many, many years been a fairly much more of an advocate role anyway. Like, I was always, you know, someone who promoted gigs for other bands, and I ran a little record label for a wee while in the late 90s, early 2000s, things like that. So advocacy was always sort of part of what I was doing, and I kind of see the PR publicist type role as being more or less the same. So it's still adversarial in the sense of, you know, it's fighting the system. You're still, you know, trying to overcome those sort of corporate obstacles on behalf of little DIY independent underground artists. But I think because of the sort of the neat underground scene that I work within, it tends to be much more cottage industry than it is sort of big corporate kind of stuff. So yeah. we're really more about like looking for allies and building networks and alliances rather than sort of finding adversaries. It's for me, it's very much about a community-based cottage industry of like-minded people just trying to make this kind of music and art sustainable for the artists that we work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I understand that. And, you know, I echo what you're saying. You know, coming from my subjective, you know, we've walked very similar lines.
weirdly. You know, from me promoting gigs and setting up record labels and etc. and being an A&R, you know, it is all about just working together in this this hyper-localism, you know, because here we are in Aotearoa, you know, literally at the end of the earth, right? And it's very hard for our sound to get out there. And we're dominated and swamped by all these international voices that don't really truly represent us. I mean, sure, they do to a point, but they're not really our stories. So it's really important that we collectively lean in and help each other, I would say.
I think there's always been, and I've heard this comment made before, it's not a unique observation, but there's within New Zealand independent underground DIY music, there's always been this idea of New Zealanders sort of punching above their weight, and it's you come in from the bottom of the world and fighting this kind of massive uphill battle, you know, to try and sort of overcome those commercial industry obstacles that might seem a bit insurmountable, but I think that's part of what contributes to a unique quality about New Zealand alternative music and counterculture is that, you know, that sense of being complete outsiders.
No, I understand. I totally get you. And like, you know, Kirikiriroa is foundational to Aotearoa Gothic rock. And standing in that packed Jellicoe Drive flat for that Distinctor member's first gig felt like our local version of the Sex Pistols at Lesser Free Trade Hall. Everyone left converted to the dark side. How did that specific energy and underground isolation of this city shape your identity before you took it to Te Whanganui, Aotearoa, and the world?
It's a big question. There's a lot of things about Hamilton, because I grew up there between the ages. Like I was born in Thames, and then my mother and I moved to Hamilton when I was 10. And so it was Hamilton was where I kind of came of age as a teenager, and eventually moved to Wellington in my early 20s. But it was a very formative time in my life, you know. I guess, like, musically, around the late 80s, early 90s, I started getting into, I was already interested in sort of bands like international acts like The Cure and kind of that sort of thing was my gateway to alternative music, I suppose. But then I started discovering local bands like The Haunting and Signet Committee and Book of Martyrs as a teenager, and that sort of made me think, well, maybe there is actually a point to playing this kind of music in Hamilton, even though it's Hamilton where there's sort of pretty much zero audience for that kind of music. I just seeing those people play music was enough to make me think, well, you know, I will do it. You know, I had sort of written off the idea at one point, but I, you know, decided, no, I will start my own band. It's very much inspired by Hamilton artists. And then later it was, once we actually got the band up and running, it was things like listening to Urban Jangle on Contact FM, which was in those days on 89, same as Free FM is now. I had a Casio tone that I used to use to like make demos at home. And I noticed there were other Hamilton bands that used Casio tones, bands like Dean and Mancini and Wendy House and Adult Garbage. So I got kind of into that, this kind of whole DIY, lo-fi, avant-pop, quirky stuff that was coming out of Hamilton, and which was quite unique to Hamilton, I think, in a lot of ways, these sort of wave of Casio tone bands at the time, you know. And then another thing about Hamilton then, and this is, we're now talking about the sort of the mid-90s when we got the Shoot the Member up and running, I found that once you knew someone in the sort of local freak scene, then you knew everyone.
True.
Because it was all connected. Like the goths, the punks, the hippies, the rusters, everybody. Clan McGillicuddy. It was all one massive sprawling community. As soon as you were a part of it, then you were connected to everyone. And I guess that's sort of something to do with like the safety in numbers thing, where because Hamilton was very much a mainstream sort of a centre, people kind of tended to flock together.
True.
Whereas in the bigger cities like Auckland and Wellington, maybe the goth scene, for example, on its own was big enough to sustain itself. It didn't really, you didn't have to hang out with punks and indie kids and hippies and rustlers and stuff. But in Hamilton, you kind of did. To make the community sustainable for everyone, you kind of had to band together. So that kind of influenced us a bit. I think it made it led me to a more eclectic kind of interest in alternative counterculture than just one isolated sort of niche, you know. And I think it's what led to us playing shows in spaces like Corso.
Yeah.
The poverty and recycling shop, and also like there was a lot of people around Hamilton at that time that were, there still are some of these people around that were sort of like fringe street performance artist type people.
Yeah.
And that had a big influence on local sort of alternative counterculture as well, was that performance art side of things, and that kind of influenced the kinds of early performances that we were putting on in Hamilton in those days as well. Like there was a friend of mine called Adam Maggot, who was a performance artist, and we performed together at Corso, and she made all sorts of amazing props, and we did all this weird sort of theatre where she pulled my intestines out of my, on stage, and it was just weird kind of horror-inspired stuff, and a bit of a Signet Committee inspiration there as well. One of the bands I mentioned earlier, they had that kind of a approach to some of their stage performances as well. The members of Signet Committee, like Dave Whitehead, I don't know if you know Dave,
yeah, but I do.
Yeah, went on to work in the movie music industry. He kind of discovered us and took us under his wing. Him and then his business partner Dave Lowndes.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave Whitehead used to be in Signet Committee, and Dave Lowndes used to be in a band called Requiem, who did a lot of gigs with Signet Committee, and they both kind of really fostered Deceptive Member a lot, and we did our first kind of studio demo recordings with them at Theta Productions, which was their audio production company. We started playing shows with people like Fallen, which was a sort of a late life incarnation of Love and Violence,
uh-huh.
and sort of hitting, more industrial kind of music, and Department of Correction, and
yep.
Usine, which was sort of weird, dark ambient, glitchy, electronic sort of stuff, and Mara, it was like a black metal band that had Adrian from Usine and Department of Correction was the singer. Janice's Lung, I think you'd probably remember Tamlin from Janice's Lung.
I do.
So that whole thing kind of was interesting. Like, it was kind of a somewhere in between industrial and punk and noise and, a whole different set of bands. Again, so long story short, there were a ton of really, it was on a relatively short period of time, because Deceptive Member was only really gigging around Hamilton sort of around 95, 96.
Yeah.
But in that period, like, we sort of absorbed, and personally I absorbed a lot of influence from other Hamilton musicians and artists and performers and people like that, And then I went back to Hamilton in the early 2000s as well. And there was a short-lived incarnation of Deceptive Member that had people like Stan Jagger and Paul Oakley and Paul Tregilgas
nice.
Play in the band. And that they were all people who had sort of mentored my generation of musicians, and that we'd all kind of looked up to. And I'd certainly taken a lot of inspiration from the bands that those guys used to play in, Book of Martyrs and Paul Tregilgas used to play in The Haunting, and thousands of bands. The Haunting was the first time I saw him play. To be able to play with those guys, it's like sort of playing with your local heroes, And
true.
Like, to me, they were as much of an inspiration as any international acts that I was a fan of. And in many ways, more so, because it was local, it was real, you had a living, breathing first-hand connection with that music.
Yeah.
As opposed, you know, it was not this abstract, distant thing in a magazine or on TV or radio. It was right there in front of you, and that became a really important thing for me. My relationship with music was about very much about personal relationships with people that I know as well.
I got to call out all the bands and the scene architects of those times. I mean, as you know, Michelle, I was there with you. And they were remarkable, and it was an absolute proving ground for me, and it really set me up to have the confidence and the drive and the vision to do what I've done. And I took those DIY, those collaborative, scene-y kind of things to heart. And when I moved to Tamaki Makaurau and started doing my own thing, I was really leading from the front in that regard, you know, because I remembered how well that worked and how cool it was. And that cross-pollination of, like you said, rusters and punks and everyone, and we're all there together doing it. And it didn't matter what you're doing as long as you're doing it. And it was hyper supportive. It was very, very cool.
Yeah, for sure.
So UTM's core ethos is to support, champion, and foster emotional community-driven currencies. In a hyper-capitalist music economy that trades strictly on data metrics and profit margins, how do you protect that human-first philosophy from being eroded by the cold realities of global PR?
There's no getting away from the fact that, you know, we live in a capitalist society, and we all need money to get by, pay our rent, and that sort of thing. And everything that we do when it comes to music, it costs money to make music, it costs money to promote music, and it's tough trying to make it sustainable, you know. And so it is inevitable that a lot of the work that I'm doing is transactional. People hire me to do a job for them, I'm also often paying for sponsored placement of the artists that I work for, or they are, you know, we work together to find them, you know, the right places to advertise or to put sponsored content and that sort of thing. You can't realistically reach a larger audience without being prepared to invest in promotion to some extent. You know, like even if you are part of a community like, say, the DIY punk scene, which is very much supportive, underground, anti-capitalist, non-commercial thing, and very much a bit more about community than it is about industry and all that sort of thing. You look at the example of like Kieran from Schwitter to Foot, who you've been speaking to. Even he has to sort of invest quite heavily in his music if he wants to get out there and get it heard in Europe and, you know, around the world. He still benefits like from being a part of that DIY underground community, and he's still very much a part of that, but it's just inescapable that you do have to sort of make some kind of concessions to the fact that we live in a capitalist society, you know, and there's, I think, like, the way that we balance that, I'm thinking with myself and Kieran, because we kind of have similar ethos to some of what we do. Like, there's a desire to be somewhat more altruistic or not profit driven.
Yeah.
You know, and the way you counter that, I suppose, is it's like taking pet projects and doing stuff on your own time outside of work, just because you want to, you know. And I quite often sort of pick, especially locally, projects that I want to just do. I'll reach out to people and say, look, I know you probably don't have a budget for this, but I really like what you're doing and I want to tell more people about it, you know. So let's do something. And it'll, you know, I don't want to sort of advertise that too widely.
Yeah, fair enough,
You know, I've got to eat and pay rent and that sort of thing, but like, that's one of the things that I do, I guess, to try and balance it out, is, you know, sort of pet project. I'm always sort of trying to, I guess, going above what I'm paid to.
I don't mean
that to blow my own trumpet or anything. Like, you know, I can't stand this sort of this modern culture of like everybody having to film themselves being charitable.
Yeah, same. Like, I find that ugly and gross.
So I don't want it to come off that way, you know. But I'm just in terms of, you know, how do you balance that hyper-capitalist sort of side of things? You know, I think it's important to just be sometimes doing stuff on your own time off the clock for Aroha or for Bata or just for the growth, the mutual growth of the local music community, you know, that sort of stuff. I think that's important to just always be keeping, you know, a hand in that kind of stuff, you know?
I totally understand, and you know, we're of similar age, right? So I remember, you know, being young and creative and hitting all these like insurmountable mountains and massive doors, right? And they weren't doors like, in the, of course, they were doors in the traditional sense, you know, corporates, but companies going, no, you know, you got no experience. But it was more so peers. Right.
Yeah.
So, and I remember the horror of that, and like going, well, you know, I've got something to say. Help me say it, you know. So, I now, as an elder statesman, an elder OG general, because I kind of am, I guess. I like to reach down and lift actually people up. That's what I like to do, and I think we're similar. You know, I think we're similar. So I really echo what you're saying. 100%.
And I think like another way that feeds into what I'm doing is that I try to keep my service that I provide as accessible as I can to the kinds of artists that I want to work with.
Yeah.
And I know that those artists aren't making money from this kind of music, you know, because it's not a highly profitable product.
Sure.
It's about keeping prices realistic and affordable for people. It's a bit of a struggle to survive and keep it sustainable for me, but it means that I get to do what I want. You know, I'm terrible at working a job that I don't believe in. I'm just really, really bad at holding down a job that I don't feel anything, you know. If it's just a job, I'm just terrible at holding down a steady job like that. I have to feel personally invested in what I'm doing.
I understand. I think that's maybe arguably Generation X curse, just quietly. So dark wave and industrial communities want to be heard, but they fiercely guard their secrecy against mainstream dilution. When orchestrating a campaign across dozens of countries, how do you maximize global exposure without stripping away the subcultural mystique that makes the music vital in the first place?
Well, I think, again, the way that we've struck the balance there is that, yes, it's global, but it's a global underground network that we're pitching these artists to 9 times out of 10. So it's, again, like a sort of an earlier comment that I made about we're dealing with a cottage industry rather than a big corporate industry. It's not really that big a compromise to reach out globally to, like, let's say I'm pitching a darkwave band. Well, I'm going to pitch them to all the platforms that are receptive to darkwave, which tends to be fan-driven media, underground niche media. Some of the artists that I work for might have different aspirations. Like, they might be less fiercely protective of underground counterculture, and they might have ambitions to cross over into to a wider audience. Okay. And, you know, so it will depend very much on the artists that I'm working with. But, I mean, 9 times out of 10, we tend to find that that's probably not a good match between those types of artists and what UTM is doing. It still depends on the artist. I, I, do see some of the bands that I work with as having quite a crossover appeal, and I definitely advocate for that where I think it's appropriate.
And what I really love is that, you know, artists often describe UTM not as a hired agency, but as another member of the band, and that level of trust is rare, but it does, you know, really carry this immense emotional weight. And, you know, where do you actually draw the line between being a fiercely loyal advocate and maintaining the professional detachment required to run a sustainable business?
It depends very much on the artist and the nature of our working relationship. Because, you know, sometimes it may just be a case of a client hiring me to do a job, but that's actually more of a rarity for me than the scenario that you describe of, you know, like becoming a creative collaborator with the client. That's definitely the norm. And I think maybe that's just something to do with the way that creative people work together. But it's probably also just that I'm kind of just inclined towards ideas around community and culture and collaboration and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just a natural fit for me, that a sense of family might sort of develop within UTM.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen for everyone that I work with, you know. Some people just come and go, like they might hire me for 6 weeks or 3 months and then decide, yeah, you know, this is a great fit for me, I'm going to try something else. Or I might be the one that says, you know, look, I don't think I'm the right person for you guys, you know.
Yeah.
But more often than not, the artists that I work with, we do develop that sort of sense of family and community and collaborative work together, and there's definitely a creative dimension to it. And yeah. I think there isn't really any kind of conflict between that and the business side of things. I think it's helpful if we have that relationship, because then we're on the same page, we're both committed to the same goals, the same objectives, and generally, those relationships are the ones that have been the most successful.
Yeah.
Where we do find ourselves on the same page. It's where we're not, where we can't find that creative, collaborative relationship, or a sense of community with one another, that it tends not to work out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. And I've experienced it myself, and it's interesting. I've been thinking about this, and key terms that you're discussing, you know, like whānau, and like, you know, we work together, right? And for me, you know, and I'm gonna be real. Like, I'm an only child. You know, it's a tough world. So people I work with, I really lean in and like want, you know, a sort of sense of family. Yeah. Because I'm doing something. I'm being vulnerable with my creativity. And everyone else has been vulnerable, right? We're saying things that we're a bit frightened to say, but we're doing it on a big stage. So the way I figure it, well, we're all being vulnerable, we're all being truthful, let's all work together like whānau. That's the way I figure it. Speaking of whānau, so you've spoken about showing the next generation, specifically your son, that you can carve out a sustainable career without compromising creative integrity. When the presence of managing a global pipeline mounts, what is the exact internal compass that keeps you from taking the easy corporate route?
Well, I mean, he is obviously the North Star, you know. It's fine and well to have noble aspirations and high ideals and all that sort of thing, but I think most of my deeply held beliefs and highest principles in life, but they were all still pretty damn negotiable to some extent or another. Up until I had someone else to role model those values to. And that's the answer, really. You know,
That's a beautiful answer, and like I totally feel what you're saying. You know, being a parent, that North Star is always your children, right? So, and you know, like you can, you know, before you become a parent as a man, you're very isolated, you're very individual, right? You're very self-focused and me. But the second that little bundle of joy comes into life, you comes into being, everything changes. So more power to you, my brother. More power.
Thank you.
So UTM have mastered the pipeline for dark alternative music, but genres like drone and ambient rely on pure spatial emotion rather than traditional song structures. How does your promotional blueprint evolve when you are no longer pushing a traditional release, but trying to connect a global audience to this, to a sub-bass frequency or a sonic soundscape?
I'm finding that a really interesting area to expand into now, and it's something that UTM hadn't really been doing a lot. Now, I've always worked with artists, you know, like just by virtue of being part of the same community as a lot of artists who do work in that space, that sort of post-industrial, dark, ambient, drone, noise, kind of that whole area. But within UTM, I'm only just sort of having the opportunity now to start expanding into that area. So it's a bit, probably a bit early for me to speak meaningfully on that topic, but I am finding it really interesting and really exciting.
Nice.
You know, and it's something that I'm exploring a lot, but a lot of it's research, you know, and it's the one area that I'm particularly interested in at the moment is experimental broadcasting and radio art, and treating the transmission or the broadcast as the medium itself. I think that's an interesting area to explore from the traditional perspective of a publicist, where you would be seeking airplay for artists, for example. But when I'm dealing with an experimental artist, like there's a guy I work with in the States from Washington, D.C. called Jeremy Moore. He's a very prolific artist, and he records under a number of different project names. But one of the projects, his most recent one at the moment that we're working on, is called Ad Osium. And that is very much in the dark, ambient, drone, noise, post-industrial kind of space. And so the work that we're doing is about reaching out to radio stations, for example, that have that emphasis on experimental broadcasting, that have that emphasis on creating transmissions that are themselves a work of art. A lot of Jeremy's work is about interdimensional transmissions at a conceptual level anyway, so it sort of it ties in quite nicely. But like I say, early days from as far as UTM goes, exploring that space. But something that's, you know, really intriguing and exciting to explore.
Well, you got me very intrigued and very excited. We're definitely going to have to talk offline about this, Michelle. Whoa, that's super cool. So, what's a definitive unholy late night pie of choice that fuels that absolute madness of running an underground empire?
Pepper steak. They used to be steak and cheese, but you know, it's a bit boring, the old traditional steak and cheese.
That's true. I like it. I'm getting notes of you know, the spicy depths of the gravy digging down into the steak.
I like things that are dark, you know, like dark coffee, and I don't drink anymore, but I used to like dark spirits, you know, whiskey and dark beers, and you know, and pepper steak sort of, it's got a similar kind of a vibe to it. You know, it's hearty and it's rich and it's deep, but it's spicy as well, you know.
I like it, and that really sums things up. Michelle, thank you so much. Look, it's been my absolute joy to work with you and all the UTM artists. You know, I've got to give shout outs to you all. Trauma Party, Lung, I can never say it. Thank you. And yourself. And also, big, big ups to your entire roster. Thank you for everything you do. It's been amazing.
Awesome. No, thank you. Thank you very much for the, you know, taking the time and care and attention to all of these artists, you know, to do this in-depth, deep dive into what we're all doing. It's very nice to have that opportunity to, and particularly to focus on my the New Zealand side of my roster. And sort of have a chance to showcase those people and their work. It's been fantastic, but thank you very much.
My pleasure. You have a good day.
Awesome.
Bye. some pretty pills and squirmed in one and screamed and died. Nor did I find death a pathway lit by heaven's light. Just the all-consuming nothing down here in the wind.
Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.